2. London, England, October 26, 1775, 11:15 a.m. King George III has had enough. From within the plush confines of his golden royal carriage, the tall and youthful 37-year-old monarch rehearses the speech he will give from a throne in the House of Lords in 1 hour's time. The opening of Parliament, over which he will preside this morning, normally takes place later in the year, but because of the situation in America, George III has ordered that the event be held earlier. The king will soon don royal robes of crimson velvet trimmed in the soft white winter fur of a stoat. Footnote, also called ermine. A stoat is a member of the weasel family. End footnote. A gray ceremonial wig and a crown festooned with diamonds will adorn his blonde hair. To the thousands of cheering loyal subjects witnessing his journey through the streets of London, their sovereign rides in apparent luxury, seated within the satin and velvet confines of the 4-ton state coach. But the gaudy carriage has steel wheels and a Moroccan leather suspension so ineffective that riding inside is like tossing in a rough sea, in the words of one of the king's sons. The journey might be easier if his queen, Charlotte, were at his side, for he cherishes her and treasures her support. The couple lives at Buckingham House, an estate next to St. James's Park in London. Footnote: the official royal residence was St. James's Place, but George III found it confining. He purchased Buckingham House in 1761, so named because it had once belonged to the Duke of Buckingham. The estate was also called the Queen's House because of Charlotte's deep affection for the property. The structure was greatly expanded in the 19th century. For a time, it was proposed that it house Parliament after a blaze in 1834 destroyed the Palace of Westminster. Instead, it became Buckingham Palace, the official royal residence to this day. End footnote. They are thought by many to be a boring couple, fond of gardening and a frugal lifestyle. George agreed to marry Charlotte before even meeting her, understanding his traditional duties. He needed a wife. George III chose Charlotte to be his bride because she had been born in northern Germany, like his own ancestors. The courtship was bizarre. An emissary sailed from England to present Charlotte's dying mother with a contract written in Latin stating that Charlotte would depart immediately for England, convert to the Anglican Church, and never involve herself in politics. Elizabeth Albertine of Saxe-Hildburghausen, a noblewoman eager to see her 8th child married, agreed to the contract but died before the British diplomat arrived in Germany. It was left to Charlotte's brother, Adolphus Friedrich IV, to sign on his mother's behalf. Charlotte left for England immediately, never to return home again. Upon disembarking from the yacht Royal Charlotte after a stormy 10-day voyage from the North Sea port of Cuxhaven, she was whisked to London, where she met the king at the garden gate of St. James's Palace. The date was September 8, 1761. Charlotte spoke no English, and George was put off by her homely appearance, but the contract had already been signed. They wed at 9 o'clock that evening. Charlotte was just 17 years old. 2 weeks later, in a lavish coronation at Westminster Abbey, George III was officially crowned king and Charlotte his queen. In their short time together, they had already become quite comfortable with each other thanks to George's fluency in the German language. During the coronation ceremony, one famous poet in attendance, Thomas Gray, noted that the couple did not act in a royal manner. They were so famished from the long day of festivities that all pretenses disappeared. Despite their meal being served on golden plates, the king and queen, in the words of Gray, ate like farmers. Royal expectations aside, George III is a lightning-fast eater who is fastidious about his weight. Breakfast is usually just bread and butter served with tea. Fruit is always on hand for snacking during the day. Dinner is served at 4 p.m. and is a simple portion of mutton, soup, vegetables, and a pudding, all washed down by barley water. Charlotte and George do not entertain often, but when they do, it is common for guests to race through their dinner, for etiquette prevents them from continuing the meal once the king has finished his last bite. George III has come to love Charlotte deeply, despite initial concern about his bride's beauty. Their marriage will be long, and he will never be unfaithful. This is a highly unusual commitment for a British king. George is well aware that his grandfather and father both strayed from the marital bed, and he is intent on setting a different example for his children, of which there are many. Charlotte, who learns to speak English with a heavy German accent and likes to regale her husband with performances of God Save the King on the harpsichord, has been pregnant almost every moment of their 14-year marriage. The couple now has 10 children. At this very moment, Charlotte is 3 months along with their 11th, a princess. All told, she will bear 15 royal heirs. Charlotte's appearance is of mixed ethnicity, and despite many rumors, her African lineage will not become a matter of public discussion for more than 2 centuries. Going forward, however, whichever king or queen sits on the British throne will share Charlotte's African bloodline. Footnote: the roots of Charlotte's African lineage are unclear. Thanks to the intermarrying of Europe's royal families, it was not uncommon for houses from far-flung lands to be joined. Thus, Charlotte is thought to be either a distant descendant of the black Portuguese noblewoman Margarita y Castro de Souza, or of Portuguese King Alfonso III and his mistress Murana Gil, who was of Berber descent. Although portrait artists during her lifetime softened Charlotte's features to make them more British, one physician with close ties to the royal family stated for the record that she had the face of a mulatto. A poem written to commemorate Charlotte's wedding to George III included these lines alluding to her appearance: "Descended from the warlike Vandal race, she still preserves that title in her face." End footnote. Since the costly English victory at Bunker Hill 3 months ago, there have been no further battles between the British and George Washington's Continental Army. But through a long, wet summer, which has now turned into a cold, wetter autumn, George III has fumed about the American uprising. It could not have come at a worse time for him. The British people have begun to doubt his authority, equally shocked at the colonists' unruly behavior and the army's inability to stop it. On September 14th, when the transport ship Charming Nancy arrives in Plymouth, England, carrying the wounded British survivors of Bunker Hill, newspapers report the shocking sight of some without legs and others without arms, and their loose clothes hanging on them like mourning gowns. Making the Charming Nancy's arrival even worse is the presence of 60 widows and children of men lost at Bunker Hill. They are devastated. Footnote: British regular army soldiers often traveled with their families. Wives did washing, worked as nurses, and sold alcoholic beverages. Children were allowed to remain with their fathers until the age of 14, when they were turned out to make a living for themselves. The widows of Bunker Hill, like all women who had lost a husband in combat, might remain with the army if they had gainful employment, but were entitled to passage back to Great Britain if they chose, as did the women returning home on the Charming Nancy. End footnote. The ship itself reeks of squalor and rotting flesh, an aroma so powerful that it can be smelled before the ship docks. The British may have won the Battle of Bunker Hill, but it is obvious that the victory came at a great price. Soon, the returning soldiers began sharing their battlefield memories, explaining how the best-equipped and most highly trained army in all of Europe was nearly defeated by a ragtag bunch of colonists who lacked a clear chain of command. They told of the British General William Howe being so confident of triumph that a servant rode into battle at his side with a bottle of wine to slake the general's thirst. They also described the bravery of their American opponents, who refused to fire until the British were just 50 yards from their breastworks, thus ensuring massive slaughter of the tightly packed redcoat columns. Footnote: the phrase "Don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes," is said to have been coined at Bunker Hill by Continental Army Colonel Israel Putnam. This myth was propagated by 19th-century writer Mason Weems, the same man who concocted the legend about George Washington chopping down the cherry tree. In fact, the rebels were told to wait until they could see the tops of the gaiters the British troops wore around their ankles. Gaiters worn in America were black. Only those of the foot guards in London were white. In any case, "whites of their eyes" was first uttered by Prince Charles of Prussia in 1745 and Frederick the Great in 1757. End footnote. Officers were a favorite target of the colonial militias because of their brightly colored uniforms and the shiny gorgets protecting their throats. But it was the horror of the third and final assault on the colonial positions that signaled to the people of England that the Americans had every intention of fighting to the bitter end. The rebels eventually retreated after they ran out of ammunition, with many of them shot in the back as they fled. But those who remained wreaked havoc on the British when their lines were finally breached. Despite the futility of that moment, when all was obviously lost, the Americans threw rocks at the attackers and swung the butts of their muskets as war clubs. British bayonets made quick work of those colonists, slaughtering so many in such a short period of time that the redcoats had to climb over the bodies of the dead to continue fighting the living. One British officer summed up the fighting this way: "We expected rather to punish a mob, rather than fight with troops that would look us in the face." Shortly before Charming Nancy's return to England, George III issues a proclamation for suppressing rebellion and sedition. He acknowledges that the colonists have been misled by dangerous and ill-designing men, forgetting the allegiance which they owe to the power that has protected and supported them. He then goes on to authorize atrocities, including murder, allowing British troops to use their utmost endeavors to withstand and suppress such rebellion. Although King George III is usually a measured man, he is ruthless about imposing British power. 2 years ago, the oppressive British Tea Act of 1773 made British tea available in the colonies at a lower price, after tax, than any other imported tea. The colonists saw through this scheme, recognizing that buying this inexpensive tea would mean paying taxes without parliamentary representation and would set a precedent for further taxation. Rather than give in, American colonists dressed up as Indians, raided 3 British ships in Boston Harbor, and dumped their cargo of tea in the water to protest, an act so flagrant that Parliament passed what had become known as the Coercive Acts. It was Prime Minister Lord North's intent to make an example of Massachusetts in an effort to discourage other colonies from fomenting rebellion. The port of Boston was closed until the destroyed tea was paid for, thereby punishing the entire city for the acts of a few. The Coercive Acts also stated that British officials who faced criminal charges could be tried outside of the colony, meaning that witnesses would be unlikely to attend such a trial. Troops could be housed in any available vacant buildings and were to be fed at the expense of the colonial government. Finally, and perhaps most important, the Massachusetts Colonial Charter was revoked in an attempt to give the British government direct control of the colony. It has been 12 years since Great Britain has waged war, but its attempts to strangle Boston and its inhabitants is akin to a military siege. If Parliament has its way, that raucous rebel town will learn the hard way that England is its master. The plan backfires. The Coercive Acts, known in America as the Intolerable Acts, are far too punitive. It is clear that Britain no longer believes the American colonists are entitled to the same rights and privileges accorded free men and women in England. The people of Massachusetts create their own government, in defiance of Parliament's authority. Instead of distancing themselves from the besieged people of Boston, the other colonies band together and form the First Continental Congress. There, the true seeds of sedition are sown. The battles at Lexington and Concord, and now Bunker Hill, are proof that a direr form of punishment is required to control the Americans. For King George, a tipping point has been reached, one from which there can be no return. He is a strict man. The rebels are children who must be slapped, if necessary, to bring them to heel. I am of the opinion that once these rebels have felt a smart blow, they will submit, George has informed his good friend John Montagu, 4th Earl of Sandwich and 1st Lord of the Admiralty. Thus, the king refuses even to read the olive branch petition sent by the Continental Congress as a last attempt at reconciliation. Now, on this very morning, the man the rebellious colonists once considered their benefactor wants nothing less than their total destruction. George III is a deeply spiritual person, prone to spending hours in prayer. He does not see the rebels as virtuous, nor does he condone the argument that Parliament has no power to levy taxes upon the colonies. American dissenters believe that because they have no voice in the House of Commons, they have no obligation to pay taxes. King George III is adamant that British colonies obey and provide support to the motherland and that they not be entitled to any representation. Reports that American colonists see themselves as equal to British subjects have enraged the king. He is having none of that. So now he must act. George III means to declare war. This declaration is not an act of insanity, though in time the heavy amounts of arsenic in the ceremonial wigs the king wears each day may be a reason his urine is turning a vibrant blue and he is losing his mind. Footnote: Arsenic, from the Greek word for potent, was once considered a medicine. It was long used to treat syphilis, asthma, and eczema. It is still in use today as an aggressive treatment for acute leukemia. During his reign, George was often given a medicine known as James Fever Powder, which contained high levels of arsenic. A powder form of arsenic was also sprinkled on the royal wigs to prevent them from decay and insects. End footnote. George III's actions are a statement of power. He controls 31 colonies around the world, some of them gained due to the explorations of Captain James Cook, who has recently returned from a second circumnavigation of the globe. That voyage brought the newly discovered continent of Australia under the king's power. The loss of the American colonies would be a crushing blow. As an island nation, England is highly dependent on the natural products of its colonies to ensure its wealth. Should the American rebellion be successful, other highly profitable colonies such as Canada and the West Indies might follow suit. Also, rival nations such as Spain and France might see England as weak and pursue their own colonial ambitions more aggressively. The loss of the American colonies, in other words, would kill England as the world now knows it. "We shall be reduced to a miserable little island," British writer Horace Walpole will state about the prospect of losing America. "We shall lose the East Indies as Portugal did, and then France will dictate to us more imperiously than we did to Ireland." King George is the most powerful man in the world, and he means to remain so. The House of Lords is a narrow room with the king's ceremonial throne at the far end. King George III takes his seat as the red-robed peers now look on, waiting to hear why their sovereign has called this early meeting. "The present situation of America and my constant desire to have your advice, concurrence, and assistance on every important occasion have determined me to call you thus early together," George tells them. As a child, he was often depressed and somber. In adulthood, that demeanor has given way to a powerful air of steely determination. "The rebellious war now levied has become more general, and is manifestly carried on for the purpose of establishing an independent empire. I need not dwell upon the fatal effects of the success of such a plan. The object is too important, the spirit of the British nation too high, the resources with which God hath blessed her too numerous, to give up so many colonies which she has planted with great industry, nursed with great tenderness, encouraged with many commercial advantages, and protected and defended at much expense of blood and treasure. Then, in words designed to strike fear into the heart of George Washington, King George III makes clear his intentions, and in so doing, makes it equally clear that America now stands alone. It is now become the part of wisdom, and in its effects of clemency, to put a speedy end to these disorders by the most decisive exertions. For this purpose, I have increased my naval establishment and greatly augmented my land forces, but in such a manner as may be the least burthensome to my kingdoms. I have also the satisfaction to inform you that I have received the most friendly offers of foreign assistance. The king finishes his speech to rousing cheers. 3,000 miles away, George Washington has no idea of the horror that is coming his way.